Blog Talk Radio.
By the way, Jesus was put to death by an unjust, immoral civil authority who acted in defiance to God's immutable and unchangeable justice and law. If it were not for the patriarchs of our Christian faith, beginning with Jesus Christ and even before that, but in our covenant, Jesus, Christianity would never have become a world movement. Just go read Fox's Book of Martyrs. Those people were put to death for breaking the law on purpose, because the law was evil. And we just read about Peter's good decision to verbally, deliberately tell them, I'm going to disobey you, I've been disobeying you, I'll be disobeying you tomorrow. I don't answer to you, you're wrong. And we just read about Peter saying that. Now I have a question for you. Where did Peter learn about the necessity of righteous civil disobedience? He learned it from Jesus Christ. Turn to Luke chapter 13. I want you to see Jesus engaging in willful civil disobedience. Now, there's many things we could talk about in this chapter. One, it was against the law for any Jew to own a weapon. They had removed weapons from the hands of the law-abiding citizens in this culture. Jesus tells his disciples right to their face, go buy a sword. You don't have one, if you don't have enough money to buy it, sell your clothes and get one, you're going to need it. He instructed his disciples to disobey Roman law because it is not right to take away defensive mechanisms from the law abiding. But let's look at this. Luke 13, verse 31. The same day there came certain of the Pharisees saying unto him, get thee out and depart, for Herod will kill thee. And Jesus said unto them, you go and tell that fox, behold, I cast out devils and I do cures today and tomorrow, and on the third day I'll be perfected. Nevertheless, I must walk today and tomorrow and the day following, for it cannot be that a prophet be murdered outside of Jerusalem, the holy city. Now, I love this passage because we get a glimpse of Jesus using very appropriate sarcasm. The wicked Pharisee doesn't care if Jesus is killed by Herod. He's not coming up to say, you better go, Jesus. I'm really concerned. I heard Herod's coming after you. He's not telling him that to get him to leave to save his life. He's tried just to come up with a reason to get him to go because he hates him. I'm sick of hearing this guy. I've got to get rid of him. I'll scare him away. And Jesus sees right through it. So he claims that Jesus' life is in danger and Herod is going to kill him. So therefore he should leave. Quickly, run. Jesus responds by saying more or less, oh, come on. True prophets aren't murdered unless they're inside the city limits of Jerusalem, your religious headquarters. I know what you want, buddy. And I'm not in Jerusalem, the holy city, so no one will probably murder me. You only get murdered in the holy city, the religious place. That's where you get murdered. But then Jesus makes this conversation even more fun by pointing out that the Pharisee is in cahoots with Herod. And since they're so tight and everything, you know, since the Pharisee's presenting himself as the guy in the know on what's going on back at Herod's palace, the king, Jesus says, you go tell that fox that I'm too busy with God's work to worry about his assassination threats. Now, since you're not a part of a 2,000-year-old Jewish culture, you probably don't know how much Herod would not have appreciated being called a fox. Because in Palestine, when somebody called you a fox, it was just that you meant to say they were destructive, selfish, cunning, and contemptible. So as we speak of the impact of Jesus Christ on the realm of politics, please keep in mind that there are few things in the world more powerful, in the realm of politics in particular, than the looming possibility of influential numbers of people engaged in willful civil disobedience, feeling they're justified. Just ask England about 1775. Jesus sent a message to Herod on that day that basically, you can break down Jesus' message. Here's my message. Run back now and tell Herod I said it. Three parts. Here's what Jesus is saying. Number one, I have no intention of obeying your usurpation of true authority. Number two, you are destructive, selfish, cunning, and contemptible. Number three, in contrast with you, Herod, I am busy doing good things. Leave me alone. This is where Peter learned about the need for civil disobedience on occasion. He learned it from Jesus. Jesus was not a doormat for abusive civil authorities, as some false teachers teach, that Romans 13 tells us we obey authority regardless of what they say, and that is hogwash. The Bible condemns an abuse of authority, and it does not command people to follow along with an abuse of authority. Jesus was not a doormat, and he did not always turn the other cheek out of context, as everyone likes you to think. Righteous civil disobedience, when it's called for, is a necessary part of what constitutes true Christian faith. There are no laws, local codes, regulations, constitutions, or human governments that have a right to usurp the authority of the Bible, and you must not obey them when they try. The biblical truth of what I just stated was the entire justification used by our own founding fathers against England to birth America. Read the Declaration of Independence. That's what it is. A theological exercise of why they don't have to go along with the false teaching in England's church of the divine right of kings. They took them on Romans 13 and said, you are teaching wrong out of Romans 13. It's not true, and we're not going to go along with it. You are contemptible. You are usurping authority. You are a fox. Now, in contrast, unrighteous civil disobedience naturally is deplorable. Yet even the example of unrighteous civil disobedience, as it's seen in the events surrounding the crucifixion, reveal the powerful political impact that such a measure can have. Pontius Pilate and the Jews screaming, "Crucify him," is Exhibit A. Why did Pontius Pilate sentence Christ to death when he knew he had done nothing wrong? His wife came to him and said, "I had a bad dream. Don't do anything to this guy." I mean, Pontius Pilate was in a hard place. He was under a lot of pressure. His wife was telling him, let Jesus go. He wanted to let Jesus go, but he didn't. Why? Well, the Bible tells us. He didn't because he was afraid of unrighteous civil disobedience, and that he knew the wicked Jews that were demanding that Christ be killed were going to riot, and it was going to be deadly, and then he was going to answer to Caesar for it. And you can read about it in Mark 15:15, Matthew 27:24. On the other hand, we see positive attributes of civil disobedience in full force, protecting the apostles from battery and execution in Acts chapter 5. As the story begins, turn there with me quickly. The angel of the Lord breaks the law by releasing the apostles from their prison cells. And then in verse 26, when they're rearrested, I want you to notice as we read how nicely and politely they were treated by the arresting officers. Acts 5:26. Then went the captain with the officers and brought them without violence, for they feared the people, lest they should have been stoned. Now, had the people who were prepared to defend Paul and Peter from the civil authorities, had those people not been gathered together in the street shouting their intentions to those soldiers with the intent to pick up and throw a rock if necessary, the apostles could have been severely beaten and killed that very day. That was a cause of justified civil disobedience. The authorities were wrong. An angel broke the law because the law was stupid. And the apostles willfully broke the law and went right back out in the street and disobeyed authority. How does that gel with the false teaching out of Romans 13? It doesn't. Now, I want you to listen very carefully what I'm about to say, because you won't often hear this doctrine. And it's a necessary doctrine. You won't hear it taught in the modern church. If you're a conscientious Christian living in America, there are and will continue to be laws made by our civil authorities that you must disobey in order to remain morally pure. While I could speak of many things, I'd refer you most recently to those laws passed by our state legislators concerning sexual orientation and what they now label as unlawful discrimination. In many cases, it would be immoral and unchristian for you to comply with the policies of the state of Iowa as they are enforced by the human rights commissions in our cities that have populations exceeding 50,000 people. Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't use righteous discrimination with regard to sexual orientation, you are endangering the physical, emotional, and spiritual health of everyone on your private property. By giving up your God-given right, which our founder said private property was inalienable, a God-given right, you're giving up your God-given right to control your own private property. That is unconstitutional, and it is against the Bible. James Madison, one of America's noblest founders, nicknamed the father of the Constitution, said this: "It is not a just government, nor is property secure under that government, where arbitrary restrictions deny to part of its citizens the free use of their facilities," and I insert this, "as they see fit." Now, the same guy saying this broke off from England because they ceased to be a just government. And he's saying any law that's passed that takes away your right to your private property is not a just government. Now, before men like James Madison founded the nation just over 200 years ago, did you know that at no time in all of world history, except for the children of Israel in the Bible, did any man ever experience true private property ownership? Until America. Where did our founders get the idea and make it a political and legal reality? They got it right out of the Bible. I'm going to read you a quote from Rose Wilder Lane. She wrote this back in the 1940s. She said it this way: when Madison wrote, quote, "the rights of property," everybody knew what he meant. The right to property was the essence of the Revolution. It was a right that Americans were fighting to establish. The fantastic notion that property rights can be opposed to human rights had never entered anyone's head. That notion today is part of the confusion of American vocabulary and American thinking. This right had never existed. No individual owns property in communism. No one owned property under the ancient absolute monarchs. No one owned property in Athenian democracy, where everyone's property or life were at the mercy of the majority's whim. The church maintained the theory of private property as being essential to individual freedom, the same as it maintained the equality of souls, because a right to own property is essential to individual freedom, and the church recognized the freedom, the self-controlling responsibility of souls in abstract theory. But no one actually ever owned property in the feudal system. Americans in the Revolution were fighting for a right to own property. Individual ownership of property was a daring aim of the Revolutionary War. Nothing can take his natural rights from any living person. Now, that phrase, natural rights, what's she talking about? Nothing can take your God-given inalienable rights. You can't stop gravity. And there are personal rights that God gave you that no man can take. Freedom of speech is one of them. Men don't have the right to take away what God made. He made my mouth. You don't have a right to tell me what I can and can't preach. God tells me what to preach in the Bible. And so she says, individual ownership of property was a daring aim of the Revolution. Nothing can take his natural rights from any living person. But without legal protection of those God-given rights, no one can exercise God-given rights. American revolutionists were the first to see that simple fact that no man can use his natural God-given freedom if he has no right to stand upon the earth. That's from The Discovery of Freedom, page 183, 184, copyright 1943. She had no idea that argument, way back in the 40s, that somehow or another, totally illogical, totally silly, that civil rights trump property rights. She had no idea that the homosexual community would jump on the bandwagon of that illogical argument and start winning. And I would venture to say that if you try to talk about this, some people aren't smart enough to engage in this conversation, but if you try to talk about it, most of the people you know in this culture think that civil rights are more important than property rights. And they're dead wrong. So Moses sculpted the precedent of private property ownership. We actually do see a few individuals during peaceful times in Israel's history who own private property. They're the only ones in the whole world that ever had it until America. That's amazing. And now there's forces at work in the United States that are stripping them away from you. The first big one was called property taxes. Let me explain what a property tax is. It basically means you don't own anything. You're paying rent to the government. You stop paying rent, they'll kick you off and say it's mine. So that was totally against the entire foundation of America to even start taxing property. Now we've done it for so many years, there's no way to get out of it. We're like drug addicts. We have to tax property to keep going with our fix. That's just a little American history for you. Property taxes, totally unconstitutional, totally wrong, totally usurped. You think you own property, you really don't. None of us really do anymore. But there are still aspects of private property ownership we can protect. Now they're chipping away at it again. And they're telling you, you have to let certain people rent an apartment in your apartment complex. You have to do what we say on your private property. See, they're stripping away at it. The Kelo decision, Supreme Court 2 years ago, basically said the government can come in and give a business the right to bulldoze your house. You have no property rights there. That was terribly wrong. President Bush got up and repudiated the decision the next day. God bless him. One of the most dangerous Supreme Court decisions in the history of the world. And most people didn't pay any attention. And the news said almost nothing about it because you know what? The American public doesn't even understand the importance of property anyway. That terrified me, kind of like abortion law. But I realize most people don't understand what it means to have property rights. I hope you do after tonight. The law of Moses sculpted the precedent of private property ownership in Leviticus. Jesus sanctioned the New Testament model for such a concept during parables given in Luke 16, Luke 20, and Matthew 21. And the ancient Christian church maintained that doctrine until the colonial revolutionists finally recognized its perfect beauty and established its tangible reality in 1776. Again, how did they get that accomplished? Righteous civil disobedience in the form of the Declaration of Independence. So it took civil disobedience to garner property rights, and I'm suggesting tonight, it will take some level of civil disobedience on your part to keep them. That's where we're at. So if it be true that freedom of religion is the cornerstone of the American dream, then it is also true that the legal right to own property rests most directly upon that cornerstone. I'm going to read you a definition out of the Encyclopedia International, Volume 6, Copyright 1963, Grolier Publishers. The socialist worldview attacks the legal right to own property as aggressively as it does the freedom of religion. Both are the greatest enemies of socialism. Why? Religion and property? Yeah. Why? Because socialism, quote, requires that the state abolish private ownership of the means of production, such as land and industrial plants, and replace them with public state ownership and control, end quote. Socialists want to take away your religious liberties, and they're doing it right now with the private property issue in Iowa. And all over the United States, California, my. The class envy rubbish from the socialist left that some people in our church over the years have fallen into, which is just being envious of the people that have money. Must be nice driving a nice car. Well, you're never going to drive one with that lousy attitude. Jesus taught you should be happy for people that have nice things. Why are you walking around always saying, must be nice? Well, it must be. I bet they're nicer than you. Begrudging, mean old poor person. That class envy rubbish that is instigated in the political arena all the time and encouraged. And I'll say it again, both the candidates. You can't tell me I'm being partisan. John McCain's done it, and Barack Obama does it about every day he gets up. Both of them are always instigating class envy rubbish. It is ungodly, it is unscriptural, and it's stupid. And it is rubbish, and it's from the socialist influence in America, and it presents a misleading view of their attempt to destroy private property ownership. That's what it's about. Cloaked in the deceitful portrayal of, quote, an attack against the rich, by suggesting that, quote, human rights are more important than property rights, end quote, the socialists slowly chip away at the very bastion of hope upon which human rights rest, the right to own a piece of land. Property rights are not the enemy of human rights. In fact, you can't maintain human rights without property ownership. The right to own property is the greatest safeguard to a human being's personal security and his exercise of natural, God-given, inborn rights. We have to fight to secure the legal right to own private property, and we have to preserve it from the socialist influence and the leftist elites who've been given undue influence in the American political process in both parties. A biblically accurate conservative worldview shall always place a premium upon the treasure of private property ownership, a concept planted in the pages of the Bible thousands of years ago, whose virtues were only realized a little more than 200 years ago. Folks, if you don't use righteous discrimination with regard to sexual orientation, you're giving up your God-given right to control your own property. Welcome to Nazi Germany. I would encourage you in situations like this to find clever ways to disregard these ungodly man-made laws so that you can't be successfully prosecuted. You see, there are and will be cases where Iowa state law and other states requires that you give equal access on your private property to homosexuals, transvestites, and cross-dressers without discrimination, what they call discrimination, whether that private property be a 9-to-5 business or a residential facility. And if you acquiesce and roll over and stop being salt and light, they will walk on you. And if you do that, I'm here to tell you, you're in violation of biblical forbearance law. The law of God demands that Christian people forbear and reject the unrepentant in 2 John 1, 9-11. And I can give a whole bunch of other scriptures. Jesus commanded that if someone taken in sin refuses to repent, we were to have nothing to do with them, according to Matthew 18, 15-17. Paul commanded in Romans 16, 17 that we avoid and shun those who will not accept the message of repentance as it is delivered by the local church. Paul further commanded in 1 Corinthians 16:22 that men and women who revealed, not necessarily through their words, but rather through their behavior, a lack of authentic love for Jesus Christ, were to be, and I quote, anathema maranatha, which is translated cursed and judged. Titus commanded believers to reject any contact with a heretic, someone whose belief system is in opposition to God's truth, actively subverting the meaning of our teachings by twisting the Bible in their favor. So you see, Iowa law now requires that certain private property owners must do the opposite of these biblical commands to actually welcome and foster this immoral and unacceptable government-approved behavior. I will not comply with this law as an individual, and when the day comes that our foolish government attempts to foist that evil upon our church, I assure you, Pastor Larry, Pastor Chase, Pastor Doug, and I will not be obeying it. Very recently, a Methodist church organization in the state of New Jersey refused to allow a lesbian couple to have a commitment ceremony on their own church property. And the Infernal Revenue Service responded by revoking their 501c3 status as a nonprofit organization. When a Christian photographer in the state of Arizona refused to be hired to take pictures for another similar lesbian commitment ceremony, he was subjected to an egregious, frivolous lawsuit that he is currently battling in a courtroom. And my father and brother and I won't be forced to hire cross-dressers to answer our phones. I won't knowingly allow any homosexual person to work in our nurseries. I will disobey, following the example of Jesus, Peter, Paul, and the other apostles, and I will go to jail long before that day ever comes to Cornerstone World Outreach, and may God have mercy on the knuckleheads that arrest us. You see, our lives are built upon Jesus Christ, and the materials used to provide us with strong shelter have been the words, ideas, thoughts, and opinions given to us by Him in His Sermon on the Mount. The fact that Christ's Sermon on the Mount has made a 2,000-year impact on world politics is beyond dispute. The real question is this: has He impacted your politics? I close reading Jesus' words, Matthew 7:24. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man, which built his house upon a rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell not, for it was founded upon the rock. Jesus said to an audience, I have not come to overthrow the government, but I do intend to influence it. I intend to correct crooked things that need to be leveled up. Jesus intends not only for Him to do it, He was coming to get people who would be like-minded, join Him in His goals, and that would be salt and light. He didn't say, I'm the salt, I'm the light. He said, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light. And so if it was Jesus' desire to influence, to level up, to correct, and to bring instruction and help to the system of law and the system of politics, then guess what? It's yours too. It's mine. It is our duty to stop corruption. Corruption is here. The kingdom of corruption has come. It's downtown, Jerry Brown, and we've got to stop it. And if they can do it in New Jersey, if they can do it in Massachusetts, if they can do it in Iowa, then they can start messing around with my property. And we're not going to comply with it. You better not either. You'd be surprised what willful civil disobedience can do to change. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, engaged in willful disobedience, picked up arms against his own nation. How could someone do that? Yes, he did it. Great theologian, 31 years old. He was a preacher in the Lutheran church. They took him at 31. He was married with a few children. And they hung him from the gallows. We have to assess where we're at in America. The Constitution is being undermined on a daily basis. And they justify it by saying it was never intended to be unbending. It was supposed to grow with us. Oh, how convenient. Making a painting of Jesus Christ and throwing elephant dung on it is protected free speech, but I can't speak freely from my pulpit. It's evil. And so if you were to ask me, Pastor Carey, have you ever engaged in civil disobedience? Oh, yes. Yeah, and I will continue doing that for the rest of my life as long as there are evil people making laws. And I hope you will too. You're either part of the solution or part of the problem. Someday they'll say, what generation was it? Perhaps they'll say, what generation was it? Why did those people back in the turn of the century, in the 2000s, why did the church do that? Why did they just lay there and have all their rights taken away? It's funny because we do the same thing about the Lutheran church in Germany in 1940s. We're perplexed. Why in the world would they be so impotent and cowardly and stand there and let their government murder people? Hitler began euthanizing little retarded children. It was the law. It was mandated. Parents couldn't keep their child. The soldiers came, took them away, and killed them. And we have people running for president who want to control our country. One of them is very blatantly, overtly in favor of infanticide. I never forget when my son was born, Solomon. When his head came out of the womb, he got stuck because he had the umbilical cord around his neck. So when his head came out, he opened his eyes and he looked back and forth like, what is happening? And it was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And I was overwhelmed with the sensation of partial birth abortion, where that baby comes out and opens his eyes and looks around without any anesthesia. They take a pair of scissors and they stab it in the back of the head, puncture through the skull, rip open their skull with no anesthesia, and then suck their brains out. And Barack Obama supports that barbarism. Shame on him, calling himself a Christian. Liar. No church supports that. And in Nazi Germany, those churches that did nothing were no better. We have our own Holocaust right below us, and we do nothing. And we go out and think we can be justified to vote for wicked people. Shame on the church. Foolish ministers in the charismatic movement getting on TV singing the praises of these wicked people. Shame on them, false prophets. They'll go to hell. False shepherds, liars, thieves, Jesus said. Luke chapter 10. We better wake up and stop the evil. If there's ever anything worthy of getting angry about, it's the mutilation of an innocent child. No better, perhaps even more evil than taking a Jewish adult and burning them alive in an oven. Because at least the adult has lived long enough to sin. Bow your heads and close your eyes. Father, I pray that You would deal with the church, that You would awaken them, that we would not be pathetic like the church in Nazi Germany, carrying on, enjoying our time, saying and doing nothing about the tragedy right under our nose, desensitized to the wicked evil in our own nation, doing nothing about it, saying, leave me alone, I need to go to the mall. I'm busy. We want our country to come back to the place where it used to be, where we honored You, where the Constitution wasn't trampled on by wicked men every day. It was revered and it was understood that those principles came from the Holy Bible. Help us, Lord, to be salt, to stop the destruction and the corruption of those who are influenced by Satan in this world. To speak freely and to speak the truth and to confront evil. And help us to do it without losing our compassion for those who are deceived. We want to be a light like a city on a hill that can't be hid. And I believe that somehow You've made us that light. And You've put our building on top of that hill. And at night there's going to be a beacon of light shining off the roof. People will see it from a long ways away. It's just an outward physical sign of a spiritual reality. That You are the only way, the truth, and the life. That no one comes to You, Father, but by Jesus Christ. Shake us. Awaken us, I pray. Don't let us be apathetic. Father, don't let us take things for granted. It's like the church has been injected with spiritual Novocaine. Take it away so we can feel it, Lord. So we know what's happening. I pray it in Jesus' name.